So last night we talked about love on the side, meaning just like when you have a dish created by a special chef and they say, oh, we have this fabulous, you know, piquant ginger, habanero, pepper, garlic, onion, tangerine, lemonade, whatever, sauce. It's a specialty, you're going to love it, and you go, could I have that on the side, please, right? This is how we live our lives. The stuff that is going to make our life really extraordinary, really tasty, really juicy, really special, we want to control it. We put on the gas, and then we put on the brake, and we put on the gas, and we put on the brake. And we want to stick with, come on in, guys. We want to stick with what is ordinary. We want to stick with what is safe. We want to stick with what we know it might not upset our tummies or be or rock the boat in any way of what we're used to. And in order to really love, we should be doing it the other way around. We should be seeking out adventure, and we should be seeking out magic, and we should be seeking out the extraordinary all the time. That's, you know, they call it in the East a warrior's way of living. Hi, how are you? Good. Hi, welcome. You know, I just am not big on the warrior language, personally. I'd rather call myself a gardener. I think the work is harder. But maybe an artist is what I would prefer to say, because anyone who's ever practiced an art knows how hard it is. It's not for wusses being an artist. It doesn't mean just like whatever. But the goal of any religion, of any spiritual path, is freedom. And the goal of the artist is freedom too. So tonight I would like to talk about, Chris, move to your left slightly. There's a gentleman behind you who's going to get a crook in his neck. There you go. Hi, welcome. I want to use the metaphor of art this evening because it seems to help people understand Buddhism. Your life, the way you live it, you just let it happen. You kind of let it happen. It's going to just happen, and it keeps happening. And tomorrow is a day that has a schedule that you've decided on, and people that you're going to see, people you're not going to see, things that there might be a little bit of time in the middle of the day or something where something could come in, but probably not in this culture, most likely not at all. There is no adventure there. That's for clock watchers and bureaucrats. That's a life for clock watchers and bureaucrats. That's going to be a pedestrian life, ultimately. And you're going to wonder why there is no magic in it, why there's no adventure in it, why it doesn't have that kind of spark of something special. And the feeling of being in love will happen rarely as a kind of a miraculous, random visitation. Right? But what you want as an artist of life is to be working on your life the way an artist works on a work of art. So let's go. Let's talk a bit about this. So the goal of Buddhism, I think, is similar to the goal of the artist. And it could be defined like this: to know ourselves as beings of light, willing to offer all that we are in the infinite variety of expression, in the spirit of generosity and play, to raise the consciousness of the whole and end the suffering of the world. All right? It's a lot of things. It's a big mouthful. I'll say it again. To know ourselves as beings of light. So to know ourselves as something other than the pedestrian, something other than the everyday, something other than the ordinary, and what we consistently think of ourselves as are these separate, solid beings. You know, however we feel about our bodies, they kind of are a pain in the neck, and we carry them around, and we're trying to lose weight, or we're trying to do our yoga, or we wish we were this, or whatever. filled with complaint, right? Very rarely gratitude, filled with complaint. So to know ourselves as beings of light, what we truly are. You know, they say that the mind is completely pure, it's just obscured. The purity is obscured. It's not like we have to add something or supply anything. It's there. We need to know ourselves as that. Willing to offer all that we are, willing to offer the whole thing, our vulnerability, our mess, our attempts at practice, our success at practice, our culture that we came from, our education that we came from, our limited view, all of it. Being an offering, being a living libation, wherever we're at, that day, that moment, in the infinite variety of expression, in all the expression that's at our fingertips, and in the great sophistication and intelligence that we actually have, in the spirit of generosity, giving, 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 and play. The mark of a true spiritual practitioner is that they're having fun. They're having fun. We forget. We think that to be a spiritual practitioner means, oh, you're being religious and you're all your mantras, you know. You have a spirit of humor, goodwill, and you are expecting fun. You're not expecting drudgery. You're expecting fun. I always say it's like the spirit of someone who's creating a surprise party for someone they love. That spirit. Wait till they get a load of this. Good morning. It's okay. If it isn't you, it's me. I got my phone on. I can't turn my phone off and record, so who knows what's going to happen. Whoever calls, they'll be part of the class. Exactly. Oh, yeah.
That's okay.
All right. Okay. Let them, yes, welcome them in. Hello, Kishi Michael. To raise the consciousness of the whole, okay? So the whole purpose of the day is to raise the consciousness of the whole. And that doesn't mean being holier than thou. You know, wait till you can hear from me. It's just noticing where help is really needed, where someone is bogged down, where someone is stuck, where someone doesn't realize what the possibilities are, to just softly and gently help. Just try to open a door for them. Just show them a little bit where there's air and where there's light. And end the suffering of the world, to help everyone begin to realize that they do not have to be unhappy. That Buddha said, you can end it. He said you can end it, completely end it. I mean, we have to really try to hear what he said. He said it can be over, right? Nothing but being happy, nothing but joy. Because, you know, anyway, we'll go on. In short, we're here to help, right? And we have to help ourselves first. We have to help ourselves first. If we can get out from under suffering, if we can free ourselves from the old assumptions that we've been living under, we can stop being part of the problem and we can really be of help, right? Which is the only way to be happy. So, number one, when someone says, how are you? You say, great. I'm great. And if it's difficult in that moment, then stop for a sec and just say a prayer of gratitude for one goddamn thing that you have. Because we are the top of the 1% of the world. You're not in Syria. You're not in India. You're not in Africa. You're not pulling rice out of some paddy. You're warm. You have clothes. You have a place to live. You have teachers. You have help. You have beautiful, beautiful bodies and minds. You're in health. You're alive. Whatever. Pick one, right? When someone says, how are you? You say, I'm great, right? And then let them tell you their story. But if the two of you start with your story, right? Oh, you know, There's two people right there just dragging each other down as fast as you can go, and it happens all the time. This is how we get close to people. We bond in our pain, right? Stop bonding in your pain. Bond in something else, because then you'll notice something else. I said this last night. I think we're a bit spoiled in this culture. We have so much. There's so little that we really need. That we're like spoiled kids. We complain about everything. We complain about it to each other. So try to start using the practice of gratitude. Because I said yesterday, the karma of gratitude means that if you get something good, if you do something good and therefore something good comes back to you, it could be like winning the lottery and yet it destroys your life. You know, everybody wants a piece of it from you, people resent you, etc., and it takes you right down. But if you have practiced gratitude, you will have the karma to enjoy the good things that you get. That's really worth it. Because what we really want to move toward is to be content without a lot of stuff. Because happiness isn't in the stuff, is it? And we know it. And in our culture, if we don't know it, nobody knows it. You know, we can forgive someone in India for thinking that stuff is going to make you happy. But here, we have enough stuff to know if that works, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work. People, it was an amazing article. The baby boomer generation. Boomers, right? We're the boomers, the ones who've been so successful. We have the highest suicide rate ever. Now it surpassed car accidents in that group. Middle-aged baby boomers. Yeah. The ones who have all the success are committing suicide at a faster rate than anybody else. Okay? Proof. It's not in the stuff. It's not in the stuff. So this means real change. Real change. And you know, I once was on retreat years and years ago with Lama Marut in Ireland. We were on a silent retreat together. And I really wanted to change my life. I was in a kind of crisis, and I wanted to change my life. And it took an entire silent retreat for me to realize that if I was going to change my life, I had to do something different. Really did. It dawned on me like this great revelation. Right? You have to do something different. You can't carry over the same thoughts, the same attitude. Okay, now let me give an illustration. A student said to me the other day, that they were going on a trip and that their father had communicated to them, a father that abused them when they were young, who left the family when they were 7 and has disappeared, you know, and finally is showing up and said, I would like to see you. I know you're going to be in such and such a place because I would like to begin to mend our relationship. And this student didn't want to meet with them. This father had said numbers of times, evidently, I can't mend this relationship until you apologize to me for all the things you said and did. And this student said, what, when I was 7 years old? I'm to apologize to you for what I didn't say when I was 7 years old. Now, you see, there's a huge opportunity. A huge opportunity. Because your parents are high, holy, spiritual objects because they gave you this precious human life, no matter what. They gave you that. So I said to her, could you apologize to him as you now for whatever happened? You cannot apologize as the 7-year-old because the 7-year-old had no idea what she was doing. Or really didn't understand. But you wish that there didn't have to be something that has to be mended now. And you would like to be a force for mending things. And that may or may not be possible for that person, but you see, that's change. That costs her. See, it will cost you. This is like actors. When actors play a part, let's say you're going to play Othello, and Othello is jealous. Right? I mean, that's the essence of Othello. He is jealous. You are going to pay in the price of jealousy. They say you're going to pay in the local mint. You're going to have to pay the price of jealousy to play the part. And unless you're very aware, you will be jealous of some member of the cast, you will be jealous of the director, you will feel like they're getting more attention, somebody's got better billing. The person who's playing Othello is always complaining about something. Because the unconscious that lies inside that archetype is going to affect them, and the actor has to allow for its effect on them. So it's a very tricky thing being an actor, because you have to be in command, and yet you also have to be available to have it cost you in the human condition what you need to play the part. So it's a little bit like that for human beings when you want to change something. When you're going to take on a new role, it's going to cost you in the local mint. So this person is going to have to let go of the 7-year-old, let go of the idea there was this great injustice done, and is going to have to meet this person who is completely new, completely fresh. Today, she has a father who wants to make amends with her. How wonderful. How wonderful. Who wouldn't want a father like that? You see? But if we hang on to the coal, this is like the burning coal that they refer to in the Buddhist scriptures. That's the coal. Ow, 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 I'm a 7-year-old. I was abused. I was hurt. I'm a 7-year-old. And dad appears now and says, I want to make amends. He says, no, I'm a 7-year-old. Ow, 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 ow. See? If you're going to be loyal to that, there will be no change, and there will be no forgiveness, and there will be no opportunity, and that's going to you're going to suffer from that for the rest of your life, you know? So any time a change is made, in my opinion, there's pain, because you're letting go of something that was home-based to you. It was home. It was like home. No matter how bad it was like home. It's like people who get out of jail. They're scared. Who wants to stay in jail? But people who have been in jail are scared of getting out. They're scared of the freedom. They don't quite know what it's going to be like. Same thing when you make a real change in your life. You'll be a little scared, right? And you'll be a little sad. That will pass. It will pass. I promise you, it will pass. You will enter the new reality if you do it in a wholehearted way, not like, well, I'll put my toe in. That's cheating. That's not really doing it. Right? That's hedging your bets. If you hedge your bets, you're looking for proof that it's not going to work. You can't do it that way. You have to be a good scientist and do the experiment as if it's going to work, as if it's going to be the proof. Okay? Then if it turns out you need to do something else, you make that adjustment. But step into a new place in the river. Okay? Have the guts. Just have the guts. All right? No one knows exactly what will happen, but believe me, your wholeheartedness is going to be worth a lot. And you show up first, no matter how many times you think someone else is at fault, you show up first. Because, as I said yesterday, we are born into a context in our lives. It's like being born into a particular play with a particular script and cast and director and everything else. And you're in an Ibsen play growing up, you know, and things are really stark and terrifying and awful, especially if you're a girl, right? And so your reality is men are terrible and they're dominating and I can't wait to get out, right? Or you're born into a UNESCO comedy and you had an Italian family and everything was nuts and life is just a circus, right? And we're just all going to be together all the time and we're going to eat and have a great time, and you encounter the one who grew up in the Ibsen play and you try to have a relationship. Okay? See, this is happening all the time. Danish modern is trying to speak to Italian Baroque and wondering why it's not working out, because you're making the assumption, we're so egocentric, that everybody understands Danish modern. Everybody understands your grandmother. Everybody understands your parents or brother or insane uncle or whatever, right? Everybody understands. And nobody understands like you do, all right? You're coming from a foreign country. You are your own mushroom in the forest, all right? So automatically, if you can get a little compassion out of that, we live in our own world. The world that we see is not a standard issue world because there's nobody on the planet who could establish what a standard issue world looks like. There's nobody. There's no reference point. That's so terrifying to us, but it really helps in terms of being happy, especially in relationship. There's no reference point. There's nobody who can say, could you tell me how this should go? Right? How does it go? Right? I was saying yesterday, there's no Christmas that everybody had. There's just everybody's wacky experience of Christmas, and they're all arguing. Well, I'm sorry, but you did this wrong on Christmas. Well, what Christmas was there to do something wrong about? I mean, what's the right Christmas? Right? Everybody just had their own Christmas, and this is how we're all living. So that's the beginning of compassion. All right? We only know each other very tangentially, even if we know each other really well, even if we've been living with each other a long time. I have people come to me all the time to ask for help about their lives. I have many couples that are about to break up after 35 years, and they say, we didn't even know each other. It's so sad. Because actually, if they had understood from the beginning that that's kind of a given, you know? Like, yeah, you don't know each other. You had years and years of experiences without each other, with all kinds of prejudices and likes and dislikes and rules in your family and, you know, I mean, my God, when I got together with Rick, with our kids, it was like, you know, World War III at times, because did, you know, who got up on the ladder and put the star on the tree? Well, we didn't have a star, we had an angel. Well, now do we have a star and an angel? What do? You know, I mean, you know, on Easter, my mother cut out little rabbit's feet, four of them for each step of the rabbit. And those had to be cut out at night and colored, and they were to go from each child's room along this huge path and over the piano and under this and around that to the Easter basket. Well, you know, the first night at 11 o'clock that I said to Rick, we have to now, he said, well, let's do them on the computer. I said, no, no, we have to cut them out by hand. You don't do this on the computer. No. Like, he was enraged. He was enraged. I mean, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, we're like putting these little things underneath the chickens in the chicken coop and painting the eggs and putting them underneath the chicken. Oh, my God. Same thing at Christmas. You know, he started to wrap the stocking presents about 4 o'clock in the morning. We had three kids. And he was wrapping them with the same wrapping paper that Santa wraps the presents.
No.
He had to unwrap them. He had to unwrap them. Then I said, okay, I'll do that. Why don't you write the letter from Santa? So he started to write the letter from Santa, and he handed me this thing. It was about this long. I went, wait a minute. You have to refer to each person. You have to say something about each person. You've witnessed their lives that year. You have to talk about how good they've been and what they've done. At that point, he just said, I quit. I quit Christmas. I am no longer doing this. You come from a family of writers. You write the bloody letters. And he went to bed. Okay. I mean, this could have broken up our marriage had we been, you know, a little more stressed. But you see, there is no... See, there's two cultures there. There's cultures coming together. There's worlds coming together when people come together. Okay, so have a little perspective. Have a little understanding. Thank you. I thought I had another pair of glasses. Thank you. Mm-hmm. See, I love it.
The other pair is basically...
Guess I know they're on my head. Damn it. It's like the worst exposure when you do something like that. I know.
I never
do. You're wearing them. I just feel so stupid. Okay. So, Lord Buddha said, our pain is real. It's real to us. Anything, you know, this whole idea of things being empty. Things being empty in Buddhism. Who in this room has not heard this concept? Anybody? If you want me to talk about it more deeply, I will. Forrest.
I don't know much about it.
All right. But you know what you like. I don't know
just,
much about Buddhism, but I know what I like.
Forrest,
for you, I'm going to... Yes, okay. Very important. You're welcome. I'm glad you raised your hand. So the fact that everything is changing is one aspect of what they call emptiness. That they say we and every object in our world is changing about 3 trillion times a second. Right? And our modern physicists say we only know that because that's as fine an instrument as we have to measure. It's probably faster than that. Okay? So, you know, when you wake up as I do 3 months from now and there's like a little wrinkle here that never was there the night before, I don't know how that got there. That has been happening for a long time. It was on its way. It just showed up to me at that point, right? We are breaking down, you know, from the moment that we're born. We're changing, right? Everything is changing. So then the question is, why do we see things as stable? Why do we see things as a whole? Why aren't we just seeing this constantly fluttering field of moving molecules? Right? Energy and information, which is what we basically are. Matter and energy are exchangeable. So Buddhism says the reason why we see the things that we see, because not everybody sees the same thing, which is why we don't have a Christmas that everybody had, why there's not a world that everybody is inhabiting together, is because of what we've thought and said and done in the past. So they say there are three worldviews. One is that there is an almighty, omnipotent God that is the creator and that micromanages things, is basically in charge. Or two, that everything is random. You can't have a partly caused world and a partly random world. It has to be either all caused or all random. It would be absurd to think that there could be a caused world in which there were also random events. Because something had to have caused the random event. So nobody really believes that there is a world that's totally random. It would mean I could walk through that curtain and be in Fort Lauderdale, which would be nice, but it ain't going to happen, right? And a caused world is kind of interesting. Because otherwise, I am totally at the mercy of a God that I'm not in contact with. Even people who are very devoted Christians, Jews, Muslims, etc., would, I think, agree that God would expect them to take personal responsibility for things, for their lives, for instance, for their own morality, for their own actions, right? I don't think many people believe in a God where, well, sometimes in the Middle East, where it is written, as they say, it is written, so whatever. But I think most people that really are practicing a religion feel that they are participating in trying to become like their God, in trying to do unto others, etc., etc. Okay? So Buddha said, it is absolutely your thoughts which promote your speech, which promotes your actions, that has results. They create causes for things. So if I lie continually, pretty soon nobody will trust me. It's just logical. It makes sense, right? If I steal, pretty soon people are going to start locking things up and not inviting me over. It's just logical. If I'm constantly happy that other people are unhappy, I'm going to be without many friends. And if I'm unhappy that people are happy, if I'm jealous all the time, nobody's going to want to be around me either. Okay, so like the top 10 virtues and flip side misdemeanors in Buddhism are very similar to the top 10 in any religion, the Ten Commandments or anything like that, that you do not kill, you do not steal, you do not commit sexual misconduct, you don't lie, you tell the truth, you don't gossip, you have meaningful speech, you don't have harsh speech, you have gentle speech. What's the fourth one of speech, guys?
Divisive
speech. You don't. Yeah, that's a big one in our culture. You don't divide people by. And I say divisive speech can happen this way. Right? You just lift your eyebrow when somebody walks in the door, like, oh, like that. That's divisive speech. That's telling someone, oh, don't talk to them. Right? You don't wish people harm. Even if you think that if they were harmed, it would be divine justice, and you aren't unhappy that they're happy, that they're getting something good that you want. be happy for people if they're happy. Happiness is hard to find, and people who get things that they think are making them happy are going to lose them. So just be happy they're going to be happy for a little while until the car breaks down and the new computer won't boot up and the phone will get dropped in the bathtub and whatever happens. Okay, they'll lose it. And then the last one is worldview, that you hold a view that everything is changing, that nothing has a fixed identity of its own. So they would say that this pen appears to us as a pen, right? But if we actually tried to break it down, we could say, well, it's dependent on its parts. So let's see, it has a top and a bottom, let's say, and then the sides. Does the top have a top? Is there a top of the top? Is there a bottom of the top? Is there a side of the top? Well, how about the top of the top of the top? How about the top of the top of the top of the top, right? Until we can analyze this until it's practically unfindable. So there's something about the reality of this pen that we depend on. See, we depend on the pen. We think it's always going to write. We're upset. Oh, you know, we use an expletive when we pick it up and it doesn't write. It was always going to write. Something like that goes on with us with everything. We're upset when the car breaks down, the computer doesn't boot up, when my Dropbox says I can't put the teaching in it because it's full. It was never supposed to be full. Right? See? And if a dog comes in and I drop this on the floor and the dog chews on it, it's a chew toy for the dog. So who is right? And we would say both of them are right. From the point of view of the dog is right. From my point of view, I'm right. But the dog is not wrong. And this is major, because when it has to do with two people's religions, and I say they're wrong, then it's World War III. And then they say an interesting thing. They say, if we left this object here, and the dog and I left the room, what is that object then? What is that then? So if there's no one there to name it something or to use it for something, they say because the subject is empty, it could be, you know, a hair pick for someone in the forest who'd never seen a pen. It could be a chew toy for a dog. It could be an ice pick for an Eskimo. You know, it could be a digging tool for someone. It could be anything. So then when you apply that to your angry boss and you say, he's a jerk, and you start to sort of gather people around you at work, right? Come on, let's all go out to lunch and talk about what a jerk he is and how we can get rid of him at work. It's a total mystery that that man goes home to a wife and kids who come running to the door. They just don't know him. They don't know him like we do. We've got to warn them, you know? That's the beginning of the recipe for unhappiness, because that jerk does not exist essentially on his own as a jerk without your perceiving him as a jerk. Someone else doesn't perceive him as a jerk, so that's proof that he is not a jerk from his own side. You understand? Not self-existently a jerk without my applying the label to him. If I want to disappear my boss as a jerk, I just stop being bothered by him, and poof, that boss is gone. See? So then Buddha would say, then it's up to you, isn't it, if you want to see jerks in the world or if you want to see angels in the world. If you want to look for what is angelic about your boss, go right ahead and try to let go being irritated by them. I just had this example with a student who came to talk to me about their boss, who is someone who very mechanically comes in the morning and goes, hello, 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 and then moves on, like that way every single morning. And I said, what do you say? She said, well, you know, we know it's coming, so we just put our heads down. So, right, it's like kids. You know, who's going to give up the toy? Like, mine, no, mine, no, mine, no, mine. Like, it's like Israel and Palestine. I'm sorry, guys, it is. Somebody has got to say, wait a minute, you come back here. You say hello to us very mechanically every morning. We never even get a chance to say hello to you. Sit down a minute. How are you? How's your day going? My name is, and this is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so. We'd love to know you better. I mean, grab your sense of humor and just head right for it. See? And then you're going to break that chain. You're going to break that chain. You're going to start to have fun with that guy. He goes, hello, hello, hello. I said, how do you know why he does that? I say, oh, he's just, you know, can't bear the guy. I'm like, how do you know why he does that? You don't know. What if he has a terminal illness? What if he's got something really on his mind? You don't know anything about him. You just see, this is what we do. They say we elaborate, we project, we start to build stories. We make stories. We can just collapse them like a little fan, you know, and just put them away and say, every moment is open. It's you that drags your history, your thoughts, your previous actions, the way you've done things, the way your family does things, the way everybody does things at work. You know, this person said, well, I kind of go along with the crowd. I said, well, wow. That's never been a recipe for, you know, good thinking, has it? Because in a crowd, you can get away in your own mind with things that you really would not want to be guilty of standing on your own. You know, in a crowd, there's a kind of protection for lousy behavior. Well, everybody's doing it, right? That's not good moral sense making. See, so you can just turn it around on a dime. Turn it around on a dime, but you have to notice that you're creating the labeling of that person. Jerk, nice. And often a person doesn't have a chance. If someone appears to you in your life and they look like your aunt so-and-so that was always really mean, well, that person is going to have a harder time with you because they look like aunt so-and-so. And you've got to say to yourself, aunt so-and-so is not in the room. She's not here. The fact that this person has this color eyes and this kind of curly hair means nothing. It doesn't mean she's about to be mean. That happened a long time ago. What's in the moment now is fresh. If you don't want someone to be mean to you, what do you do? What would you do? Be really sweet to them. Be really sweet to them. Cut off your projection at the pass, you know? Cut it off. Just say, I'm not taking that road. If I don't want to see someone be mean to me and I'm anticipating it, you know, you're like, meh. You are. I got your claws out already. Just retract the claws, right, and hold out a paw, you know, and just say hello. Just say hello. Everyone wants the same things. Everyone wants the same things. Everyone wants to be sweet to each other, ultimately, and for people to be sweet to them. So, you know, when you work on stage, you go into a scene, and playwrights know that we don't say what we mean. So when an actor has a script presented to them, we have to go underneath the words. Words don't mean anything, by the way, guys. Words have no meaning whatsoever. They have no inherent meaning. Words are empty. That's a wonderful place where you can see emptiness. The word rock doesn't have any quality of hardness or grayness or blackness or whatever. And there's a million words for rock. It means nothing. I can say to Leah, you're nuts, right? And she'll know that I'm expressing affection for her. I can say, Leah, you're nuts. And she knows I don't want her to do something. Same words. So we only understand words by the intention that we're shooting through them. The words themselves have no inherent self-standing meaning without my using them for something. Words are empty. Right? So things don't have a self nature. That means they also don't have good or bad qualities at all. At all. Pema Chodron, you know, jokes with her ex-husband who walked up to her on a porch one day and said, I don't love you and I'm sleeping with other women in the middle of their marriage. And she thought her life was over. She thought she was going to lose her mind. She now jokes with them. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. I discovered who I really was. I became a nun, and I'm happier than I've ever been. So what she thought was the biggest disaster of her life turned out to be the most extraordinary turning point that she's eternally grateful for. And when disasters happen to you, you don't know whether they could be the most extraordinary turning point in your life. You don't know. They could be. They could be. There's at least 50% chance that they could be. Maybe more. Right? Because a disaster is just an event. It's empty. It's your interpretation of a disaster that makes it a disaster. That makes it a disaster. And you know, glasses. What did I do with them? Here. I can't see them. I'm going to see through, and I have bad eyes. Oh, my gosh. So, so far, should that help a little bit? Okay. So Buddha said our pain is real. In other words, things function because they're empty, because they're not one way or the other, because they're not fixed. They can operate as different things for different people, or they can operate as something good for one person and bad for someone else. Garlic is really wonderful for some people who've been raised in Italian families. You know, I don't want it in my house. It's got health benefits, they say. It comes pouring out of my skin and no one will sit next to me in the theater. Right? See, garlic is not good or bad. So, for instance, saying that garlic has health benefits, that works for some people. But you might give it to someone and say, oh, take this. This is going to be fantastic to what you have, and it might cause them to throw up. Right? And you think, oh, that's wrong. It's a healthy thing. Right? So we can get very cross with each other when things that we say work don't work for that person. We can get cross with each other even as spouses and whatever. What do you mean you don't like this? This is good for you, right? You know, and it's not good for you, according to you. So Lord Buddha said our pain is real to us. It has a cause. It is a caused thing, suffering. It can end and there is a way out. That's astounding. That's like being in a fairy tale. It's like being in a story to have someone say that to you. We are so convinced that it's not true that we can barely hear it. We can kind of hear it, but we can barely hear it. Because we think that the arenas where that kind of thing happens is in an imaginatory realm. And I was talking last night about how we make the distinction between ordinary thought and the life of the imagination. Buddhism wouldn't make that distinction. They'd say, it's all your imagination. The world that you see is your imagination. It is created in your mind. Buddha is created in your mind. There's a different Buddha for everybody in this room. Right? Just as when I go on stage and I say that I'm Ophelia, well, everybody knows I'm not Ophelia. Everybody knows who I am. My name is in the program. I'm wearing a costume, right? But it's a game that the audience plays with me, that they will see the actions that I perform on stage as the actions of Ophelia, and they will make a little necklace of those actions, and they will call that the character Ophelia. And that character will kind of hang in midair in between us. There is no such thing as Ophelia anywhere in the room. I am not trying to make believe I'm Ophelia. There's no possibility that I can do that at all. I can't believe that I'm my mother and I know her better. Right? It can't. Belief is a very difficult thing. Action is something that's very eminently possible. And when you keep performing certain kinds of actions, you will get certain kinds of results. And people will see you performing those actions, and the character that they see you as will start to hang in midair between you. And you will become something to them, perhaps, that you haven't been before, You know, we all have this possibility for growth. So you change your actions, you will be seen differently. Okay? Everybody have a understanding what I'm saying? All right. If you have a question at any point, just ask me. It's like Groucho Marx says, these are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others. Okay. So, you know, within Buddhist statements, it seems that there is more than one reality. There's the reality of this painful world that he's acknowledging that we inhabit, and this other one, which is at the end of, there's a way out, you know, over the rainbow. So, the imagination is defined, interestingly, the power of conception, thought, and representation, form, used in artistic expression, or the power of conceiving thought and giving artistic form to that which is non-existent, known, or experienced. Okay. Sounds like they're talking about everything. But I think what they're trying to say is that there's something unimaginable about the imagination. There's something unimaginable about the imagination. We're giving artistic form to that which is non-existent. Okay? Never been seen before live on the stage. Okay? So if you think about ordinary thought, I think we think of it as maybe a little heavy, a little pedestrian, sometimes not quite trustworthy, a little out of control. We'd probably want to lock it up in the basement. It would live, you know, below house. We think of the life of the imagination. It's breezy. It's full of light. We want to own it. We love owning it. It makes us feel really good about ourselves. We see ourselves as far more glorious than ordinary when we are inhabiting the life of the imagination. Emily Dickinson says, I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose. So possibility and poetry are the equivalent to her. She was a high, high spiritual practitioner. She was a tantrika. She really was. She wore nothing but white. She never went out. And she lived this very reclusive existence where she struggled to know God. And during the time that she lived, there were these huge sweeps of religious conversion going on all around her, and she refused, she just refused to bow her head to that. She said, no, I am going to know who God is, and I'm not going to just willy-nilly run to some meeting in a tent. She says, I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous for windows, superior for doors, of chambers as the cedars, impregnable of eyes, so many rooms you can't even see the end of it, and for an everlasting roof, the gables of the sky, of visitors the fairest, for occupation this, the spreading of my narrow hands to gather paradise. Phew. Woman could write. You know, there's the life of the imagination. It's open. It's breezy, it's elevated, it's beautiful, angelic, of visitors the fairest, and for occupation this, the spreading of my narrow hands to gather paradise. So there's something about the life of the imagination that I would like to say, if you begin to understand that the life that you are creating each day is the life of your imagination already, you've just labeled it, just like every other day. Going to work, oh my God, I'm going to encounter so-and-so again. I have to do this. I'm obligated to do that. I'm sorry, I don't have any time for you again. Oh, I'm so booked. Oh, how am I ever going to get everything done? These are the thoughts that are heavy. These are the schedules that can get out of control, that can create resentment, that make you feel like you can't wait to get on vacation and do something else, that you want to get out from under, right? The situation's open, guys. It's your life. It's your life. You can create any kind of life you want. You are not stuck. You are never stuck. Everything is changing a mile a minute. And you can step into the river wherever you want. Okay? Wherever you want. If you're in a deadbeat job, you can drop it and create a foundation. You know, we don't need a lot of the things that we think we need. We need to be happy. It's more important to be happy. All right? And if you were truly happy, you would let those things go easily and sweetly and lightly. Okay? So our imagination is a place that we go for comfort, we go for relief and pleasure, for building something new. It's associated with the sweetest and most intimate memories probably of childhood. It's an escape, a cave, a forest, a castle, a meadow, a paradise. Or it could be a nightmare. But because it's the imagination, we aren't afraid of it. We aren't afraid of it. But behind the possibility of imagination is the fact that we do own our thoughts, that we do create things with our thoughts, and that we can move off the dime and we can rise above them. Those thoughts can take us to any plane that we like. We don't need any transportation other than that. So let me just use the metaphor of drama for a moment further. Dramatists create an imaginary world that actors step on the stage and inhabit. It's a mandala. It's a total mandala. It's a made-up world. And it's built for the highest reasons, which is raising the consciousness of the whole, waking everyone up. So it's based on love. It appears to be based on conflict. Right? But actually nobody leaves the stage. See, it makes it very different from life. You know, I'm getting a divorce. Right? There's no possibility of that in a drama. Everybody is going to go through it. So it's an engine of peace. It's a place that creates order and balance. Peace in the sense that it simplifies things so that we can look at them. Right? It gives spaciousness to us. We are over here, the actors are over there, and we're all making this agreement to work with this play as something slightly removed from us where we can consider those issues and nobody gets hurt. It's the opposite of reality TV. Reality TV is reinforcing the very worst fears that we have, which is that everyone is out for their own survival and that everyone is dispensable. Right? Everybody gets thrown off the island. Everybody gets hurt. In drama, nobody gets hurt. Even if everyone is lying there in a pool of ketchup at the end of the play. Nobody actually gets hurt. I once was in a great, great, legendary production of Hamlet at the Circle Rep, and Beatrice Straight, wonderful actress, played the queen. And when she would die, we all were in Renaissance, real Renaissance clothes. And so she had one of those beautiful lace ruffs that looks like a spider web, you know, black one up behind her beautiful red hair. When she would die, the sort of spokes of the spider web would get caught in her hair. And at any point during the play, when she was supposed to be dead on the floor, she would just sort of sit up and she would just adjust her hair and then she'd lie back down. It was a great Hamlet. So you see, we can do that. We can do that in the theater, and everybody's still okay. So an author gets to manifest all kinds of human experience, and we can participate in it. And perhaps we can clear something in our own minds in a safe place where unsafe things can be done. So acts of imagination done in order to benefit the whole will either be successful or not in the human marketplace. Right, but they will be a resounding success always in terms of human consciousness, just by posing the questions that they do. It's not easy to write a play. It's not easy to get a group of people and do a superb work of art. But the attempt is noble every single time. So all involved will have experienced grace, dignity, delight by putting space around being. As Chogyam Trungpa put it, it is the ultimate act of non-aggression. Art is the ultimate act of non-aggression. Non-aggression is the Buddhist definition of morality, non-harming. And I think it's a great definition. I grew up with the definition of ethics, doing what is right. But that definition is a little bit hinky because people can define what is right with a very sliding scale, and we all do, actually. You know, we say, well, we don't steal, but we walk out of the doctor's office with a magazine because it has a recipe in it that we want, you know. So what is stealing, right? Where does it end? Where does it bottom out? So when I encounter a script, I say to my actors, okay, describe what is literally happening in this scene. A couple of sentences, what is literally happening in this scene. So they describe the plot in the third person. Well, he comes in, all right? Benjamin comes in. Benjamin's Latino. And his father's died a couple of months before, and he comes in the scene. He's asleep. He's asleep in bed. And his mother, Maria, comes in. She comes in, and she wakes him up. And it's 1 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and she starts shaking him and shaking him awake. And then she starts telling him he has to get out. He has to get out of the house. He has to go find a place to live. He has to find a job. What is he doing in bed at 1 o'clock on Saturday? He's lazy, and he's a good for nothing, and he's not going to amount to anything. And he's like just waking up like, whoa. Eventually, they get into a big argument, and he throws his clothes in the suitcase and leaves. Okay, that's the scene as the playwright has it. The actors are not going to be involved in that. So the bad director gets up and says, okay, everybody, let's rehearse the fight scene. If the actors fight, if the actors try to get good and angry, as the director is trying to get them to do, you will end up with reality TV. Okay? It will be fake. It will be awful. Super soap opera. Everybody would just want to get out of there as fast as possible. But let's look at what these two people might actually be doing. You see, underneath the level of the words are the actions. Okay? We might say something to someone. It's not necessarily what we're doing. That's human life. One of the things that every spiritual path tries to create is for there to be a unity of speech, action, and thought so that you are whole, so that body, speech, and mind are one thing, right? That's why we do this. May we be one thing, all right? So that our thoughts are holy, our speech is pure, and our actions are loving, okay? So let's say, well, you know, the mother, what is she doing? Well, she looks like she's coming in and she's, you know, amateur actors that I teach will say, well, you know, he's probably just, you know, one of these kids who, you know, just, he's got a good thing going and he wants to hang out late. No, you don't create a work of art thinking negatively about anything. Okay? This is, all of these principles are going to apply to your life. You don't create a work of art thinking negatively about anything. You want to be constructive. You don't want to be destructive. So I say, something positive about the mother, something positive. So in the old days, teachers, and they probably still do, when they teach acting, they ask the actors, what do you want from that other person? The actor would ask, what do you want from the other person? Well, where does the test of that lie? It lies in you if you're getting it, right? The test of whether you get what you want from another person's in you. You don't want the attention on you in any drama because you want to be unself-conscious performing. You want the attention to be on the other person so that your thoughts and actions are going this way and you're not trying to pull things this way. Okay? Again, a good principle for your life. When you go about your day, are you looking for things from people for you? If drama is based on love, it's just as good an assumption that you want things for them. If the basis of the day is what do I want for them, you are going to be unselfconscious, more free, lighter on your feet, with a sense of humor available, having fun, knowing that you're part of being a help and not part of being a problem, right? And you're not going to put people, you know, on tilt when you walk in the room. They're going to go, oh, she's going to want, you know, me to help her with her computer. See, that's why I'm trying to learn how to do these things, Rick, so that I won't be saying to you, can you help me with this? So then if I say if I'm playing the mother, what do I want? As if I were a mom and my husband had died, their Latino family, the boy is still at home after 2 months, he's got no job, no place to live, why would I come in and wake him up and tell him he's a good for nothing and blah 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 blah? If I wanted something for him. What if I'm drawing the line in the sand today? That's my action. He is no longer going to be dragged down by trying to take care of me. I have to let him know I'm okay so that he can start his life after his father has gone. He does not have to be the man around the house for me. I'm going to show him I'm okay, and I'm going to kick his butt upstairs. I'm going to kick the Coke machine today. Get him going, because I know how much he loves me, and he'll get bogged down in this, and he'll get stuck, and it will be 5 years from now, and then it will be so much harder for him to get his life going, okay? Out of love for him, I'm going to draw the line in the sand, okay? Now, Benjamin, what is he doing? He has to play his action from the time the curtain goes up, and he's just asleep on stage. He's got to be doing something as the actor, because the actor isn't asleep, right? The actor's sitting there going, I wonder if my mother's out there. You know, the actor's doing things all the time. So what does Benjamin want for his mother? As if it were his mother. What does that character want for their mother? They might want to protect. They want to stay a little longer to make sure she's going to be able to be okay alone. Right? They're there to protect. So now where's the fight scene? We have someone drawing the line in the sand for the benefit of the others, and we have someone protecting someone. Where's the fight? See? This is why you got to have a good director who knows, who understands what you're doing. People think that actors are involved with words and feelings. They're involved with actions. The words will come out, and if they perform actions wholeheartedly, you will always feel. You will always feel. You will never not be feeling. And the point is, you don't know what you're going to feel. And that's when you're really acting well. When you've got the guts to go out there and not know what you're going to feel in any given moment. Because you might find yourself laughing at the most tragic moment in the play, and it's absolutely perfect. Right? It happens. It happens when people die. People find themselves, you know, at a moment, you know, just bursting out laughing, and they go, oh my God, someone just died. What am I doing? But it happens. It's just true. So now, you see, this could be our lives. This could be our lives where we plan for the day a positive thing to do or many positive things to do, positive actions. They need to be missions, not chores. If you're performing chores during your day, do not expect magic. Do not expect the miracle to descend upon your head, deus ex machina, as they say in the theater, coming down from the sky. That's not where it comes from. Right? It's a great story of Lazarus. When Christ came into town and Martha came running out, Lazarus' sister, and said, Lord, if you had been here, this would not have happened. Lazarus is dead. Now I'm going to have to wait until judgment day to see my brother. Where were you? And he says, Martha, do you believe? And she says, yes, Lord, I believe. And he says, turn. And they turn, and Lazarus is walking out of the tomb. He doesn't say, Martha, watch this. Martha performs the miracle, right? Martha is the one who sees Lazarus walking out of the tomb. See, you plant a superb day. You plant the seeds for the surprise party to happen, all right? And get up to some mischief. That's where the fun comes in. See, an actor has to tell an audience that it's a comedy in the first moment of the play, and if you don't, you can go through an entire comedy and the audience sees it as a drama. I'm not kidding. You come off the stage going, what happened? That audience is dead. And the sweet director turns to you and says, honey, we got to come to rehearsal tomorrow. You didn't tell them. You didn't let them know. You have to tell them that they can laugh. It's that clear and that simple, okay? You got to tell everyone what kind of a day it is. All right? Are you coming as a storm? Or is you coming as a rainbow? Your choice, right? Your choice. See, choosing is being on a spiritual path, constantly choosing, constantly choosing, constantly choosing. It isn't like you'll choose once and everything is going to go great. You've got to choose in every single moment because every single moment is new. It's new. So you choose now, and then you choose now, and then you choose now. This is what shamatha meditation is about. It's chopping everything up. You're sitting in meditation and you smell onions cooking and your mind starts to go, ooh, I'd really like to eat lunch. But instead you just go, now, 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 now. And you just come back to the present moment. You just bring yourself back. Doesn't matter if the mind stops thinking about onions or starts thinking about onions again or anything. You're just going to stay. You're just going to stay. You're going to stay. It's like chopping everything up into these little tiny moments so that the thought onions and how your mother made onions for you as a child and how you always associated onions with love and how you just can't bear to be sitting there one more minute because there's onions, right? So that won't lead you. See, when you act, if you are led by the words, you will be happy on the happy lines and sad on the sad lines. And the audience will never get the story. You will be narrating the words, and there's something very interesting that happens. If I try to narrate the words, give them meaning, I might say something like, I'm so cold, right? Like, people are like, what is this? You know? And that's like a bad Shakespearean production, right? Ahoy! You know, you go like, does that mean hello? What are they doing? Do you meet people and go, ahoy? You know, put your arm down. What are you doing? You know, see? And so we just have to make sure that what we're doing is very simple and clear, our actions, our actions. We try to line our words up with them to the best of our ability. But if other people won't let us, it's still okay. If we come in and we're going to make a beautiful day for someone and they're cranky, that's just like a good play. The playwright's going to give us an obstacle so that something can happen, so there's a little sandpaper going on. This sandpaper all the time. You come in, I'm going to create a beautiful day for everybody at work, and all hell will break loose the moment you come in the door. Well, it's just like knitting a sweater. You might have to go back and pick up a stitch, right? You're still creating a beautiful day. Even if you're going, whoa, 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 whoa. No, whoa, 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 me. You've got to get to the... And you didn't take out the... blah, 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 and we've got to get to this. And somebody's out. So you're going to have to take over. And they're like, whoa. Okay? Just be there and witness. See what's going on. Look very simply for where you can help. And start to help. Right? And don't be reactive. That's playing the scene in the words. And you're just going to get, I'm so cold. Right? And nobody's going to understand anything. People screaming like a bad Shakespearean production. Okay? You stick to your action. You see, a good actor will not follow whether the words are happy or sad. if I'm saying to Leah, you know, you've got guts, girl. Okay? I'm leveling with her. If I'm seducing her, you've got guts, girl. Okay? I'm doing something else. Right? You can communicate your action through whatever words you have to use. You can help somebody all the time. You can help somebody all the time by who you are being through your words. Okay? You can help someone constantly that way. Don't get all involved in the scene as you see it. What's going on underneath? Who's frightened? Okay? Who's upset that they're not going to succeed today? Who feels like they've failed? Notice, what is it that they're really doing? Not what are they saying. They may be looking as though they're bawling you out. They may be scared to death. Like the guy who comes into work every day going, hello, 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 hello. Right? Scared, maybe, to encounter everybody, to really ask. Maybe just not able to, for whatever reason. Help that person. Just stop them for a moment and say, hi. How are you? You having a good morning? Could I get you something? Would you like a cup of tea? How many sugars? Right? Just simple. All right? Just simple. So, because we're all in a play. Looking for my glasses. We're all in the play. All right? And we can all, when you're... A play is empty just like words are empty. Plays are made of words, so they're empty. That's why you can have multiple productions of a play. That's why you don't have one production, the definitive production. Right? Each day is like that. Someone is casting you as something. If you don't want to play that part, you keep playing the part that you want to play. Just play the part that you want to play. Take one word. I'm playing the part of the one who is kind. No matter what they're casting me as, you know, you didn't blah, 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 and the kitchen's a mess and blah, 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 I'm going to be the one who is kind today. Okay? That's fine. Okay? I'm so sorry. No story, not, well, I had to do this, that, and the other thing. Just clean. Just go to it and clean the damn kitchen. It doesn't matter if you didn't do it. Your karma is bringing you someone who's telling you you didn't clean the kitchen. That's your karma. Whether you didn't clean the kitchen or did clean the kitchen is not important, see? We can offer people so much by just understanding that. There is no one who can be falsely accused according to karma. Karma is divine justice. Everybody will get exactly what they deserve, eventually. You just go ahead and clean the kitchen. You will be so disarming if you do that. You will disarm people. You'll take away their guns. See, this is what we want. We may not be able to convince Congress. We have to do it ourselves. It's the way to create peace in our world, which is the only world that we know. Change our words, change our actions, right? You can't change the present in the present anyway. The present is a perfect reflection of everything that you've done and said and thought in the past. It's happening. But by what you do in response to the present, that's where, and just hang on to your little pants and say, this is a beautiful, beautiful piece of land and a potential garden. It's potentially a paradise mandala, what's being handed me here. Whatever it is, I'm going to garden. Whatever it is, I'm going to be a gardener. Okay? And you know that one of the things that makes plants grow is shit. Is total compost, right? It's what it is. And it makes plants grow. It's the thing that they need to really flower. So you can't disqualify the day because things are coming down. Say, yeah, but I can't garden like this. I think I need to leave. I think I need to count to 10. Stay. Stay, breathe, okay? Take responsibility for what you see. And just look at the person as a human being that's opposite you and say, are they frightened? What do they need? You know, do they feel that I've disappointed them? How could I make up for that? No matter what I think I've done, they think I've disappointed them. I brought that karma to myself. Somewhere along the line, I disappointed somebody. I've been a disappointment many times. I can clean up that karma right now by doing this. Never mind what you think is true or not true in Monty. Very hard to do. It requires real training. And this is where your meditation comes in, where it can really help. If you have a more stable mind, your mind isn't going to go shooting off into reactivity all the time. It's going to be able to hang in there and just sort of breathe and sort things through. Okay, I'm sorry. It costs you nothing to say I'm sorry. It feels like it's going to cost you your life. It costs you nothing. It's words. And what it can mean to another person is everything. It means they can stop yelling. It means they don't have to be a horrible person that they hate being anyway. You said you were sorry. Oh, thank God. Thank God someone said they were sorry. Okay? Costs you nothing, really. Really, really super, super habit to get into. Because if you think of it karmically, that's what turn the other cheek means that Christ said. He said, if someone strikes you, turn the other cheek and let him have that one too. Well, if you're going to pay out the karma, okay, let me pay the rest of it out. Go ahead. It's an extraordinary idea. But it's taking so much ownership. It's like, help me get clean. Go ahead, help me get clean. It's an amazing parable, amazing story. Right? You got to be a skilled practitioner to do that. Otherwise, you know, you say, okay, go ahead, the guy hits you harder and you whack them back, you know. All right, does anybody have any questions so far? Where are we in terms of time? We've been going since about 6:30. How long do you want to, what time have we got till 8:30? I don't want to overburden you guys. You want to take a break? Yeah. Let's take a break. Yeah. Yep, okay, good. Let's take a break. How are you? Oh, good to see you. I'm really good. Thank you. And your children, your family? Yes, good. Glad to hear that. You look beautiful. You do. Thank you. Thank you. That's so sweet. Thank you. No, it's okay. It's perfect. Thank you so much. These are so beautiful.
Well, they were a bunch.
I feel like I've been at a wedding or something. Thank you so much.
This is Megan.
Megan.
And I'm Katie Sullivan.
Yes. I remember you, Katie. Yeah, I remember you, Katie. And I remember that you had wanted to talk to me. Mm-hmm. Did I fail you on that score?
Well, you know what? I know you went back to LA and your mother was ill.
I know. My mother was really sick that year.
These are all the things I remember. Yeah. Whether it
and I had knee surgery. Yeah, that was a very hard time. Yeah. But if you ever want to talk, yeah. I can make up to you on that.
To talk,
okay. Yeah. All right. Do you still have my email, my number,
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah.
I'll give it to you again if you want.
Yeah. No, I have
okay,
it.
Good. Okay. Okay. Megan, thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm just enjoying so much of what you said. And we
come sit. Come sit.
Theater students. And,
oh, you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like it's just resonating very well.
What's
and
your name?
Austin.
Austin Lindsay.
It's nice to meet you.
Thank you. And yours?
Nell.
Nell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great
and
name.
So I guess the natural question is do you teach?
Yes, I do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I teach.
We're just finishing up Stella, our training at Stella mm-hmm. Heather. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, I sort of want to travel. I don't really know what I want to do before I really hit the ground, but I think it's just, I don't know,
I was just talking to someone here saying, if someone wants to set up a space to teach acting, I'll teach acting.
Yeah.
right? Teach acting anywhere.
But it is. I think, especially with Stella, where Stella comes from, is just it's all about just defining the human experience. And I think something that you've addressed that really sort of conflicts with my training so far, my experience, is just trying to seek an enlightenment as myself, and then also worrying about, you know, really committing to the freedom in the roles and how they can sort of pull me back down, and how much, you know, you sort of have to give as an actor, and while I'm trying to enlighten myself as my person.
So where's the conflict?
I just like say, when I approach a role, I think, you know, I have to get to the result, the effect of having been destroyed, or just the physical action of hurting someone. When I'm trying,
you don't ever play a negative action.
Yeah, and I'd love
ever.
That. And you know, I'm playing Rashina, and I just thought of, instead of like pushing Kaligan away, I sort of want to bring him closer so he trusts me.
Because see, if you play a negative action, you're going to screw yourself up psychologically, because you're not going to want to be seen as someone who does that.
Right.
So you're going to somewhere sabotage yourself. It's going to not help you have faith in what you're doing.
Yeah.
And everyone is making order and balance. You know, we've learned this from seeing people in prison. You know, people came from abusive families and they abused. They were trying to make order and balance. They were not bad people to begin with. There was no bad people out there. They just had a particular life that they were trying to balance out. But in every role, there are positive actions to play, and it's so exciting to do that.
Yeah. And I think it makes so much more sense when it's just the essence of theater is, and how it really is for everyone.
Yeah, theater is a democracy, small D.
And especially because we saw Orphans today, and it's such a sad story, but in the end, it is, there's so much hope in that.
Yeah.
That portrayal. And I think to honor that in that way is very healthy. And that's what I want to do. I want to approach it in a healthy way.
You have to, because you're making karma on stage.
Right.
You're making karma. Your life on stage is the same as your life in your life. You're making karma. And you also want to give people the kind of sophistication of the approach that no matter what human beings do, they're human beings.
Yeah.
They're just trying to live their lives the best they can also.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, so you're becoming a force for not judging. You can't play an actor wholeheartedly that you judge, and a part that you judge wholeheartedly.
Right.
You can't play it unless you can be behind it and what it symbolizes.
Right.
So it takes a little training to learn it, but it's worth it.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm recognizing, is that this is really going to be a journey. You know, it's just because I'm finishing a 2-year program doesn't mean that I am.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah. I would love to continue to learn on a professional level. And I don't want to stay in school for the rest of my life. But it just is, I think, it's just not having a plan and sort of just being available and just taking a day at a time. So it's so simple and so often.
I think it is a training in being simple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a practice of, because when I approach actions, I overcomplicate or just go to the negative because I'm lazy or, you know, anything like that. But actually, it's a real practice, I think.
Well, if you ever want to set up a class, even to understand how to begin to play positive actions when people are saying negative things, I'd be happy to come and teach you.
Yeah.
Well, recently,
we have studio space.
Yeah,
or we can rent studios.
And I'd love to just propose the option of. Recently, we've had speakers come in to school.
Mm-hmm.
We had Judith White come in, and Zachary Pinto, who's in the new Star Trek film and have been doing Heroes, but I don't know, I'm so fortunate to just have been in class and then see this and then right now, and then I don't know, I think you just have such an interesting perspective on life, and I think it just really comes from being open, and I'm so glad that like it just encourages more from me, you know.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you train yourself this way, even if a director says, "I want you to really punish that person," you say, "For their own good."
Yeah, and that, yeah. Especially
see,
with
the way we do with a child. Sometimes you have to punish a child for their own good, and you can translate it into get them to see the light or straighten them out for their own good. So then you avoid the cliche of, you know, you avoid the cliche. You can take it into other areas where there's more variety in your performance and where an audience will go, wow, well, they have a point too, you know? And then they struggle. Then you give them something to work on, you know? Who's right here? What do we think is right?
Ultimately show them that, it's give the audience something to see, something to take into their own lives and
Sure.
Are you interested afterwards? Go to dinner. Thinking about making a reservation.
Sure. Just help me remember to call because I had a car that was going to come pick me up. So I just have to call that car and tell them when to pick me up. Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
I'm going
to
see. I haven't called everybody here, but I think I'm going to make a quick.
Okay, thank you. Great. Forrest, was I clear at all with you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. It's a big, big, huge subject. Big, huge subject.
I want to hear more about actors, what you said.
actors.
Doesn't pretend to be.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
What us amateurs think they're
That's what I always thought happens. But you have to have some sort of imagination to, you know, understand.
Do you like green tea?
It's got a little caffeine, so.
It's all right, thank you.
You know what I mean? Nothing.
I'm going to use the ladies and then I'll come back and we'll start again.
Lindsay, this is my husband's job. Hi, Jeff. Nice to meet you. I love your wife. I'm sorry, you know, we were a little bit stressed. We had a bit of a kid dilemma going on. Okay, here we are again.
Can you hang out for 60 more seconds while I clear this card? Was there anything profound?
I don't want to miss it. Maybe, yeah.
So what's Rick doing? Is he working on a series right now? Or are they doing pilots?
No, he's in Phoenix listening to Geshe Michael right now.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Oh, he's at the
Yeah, theater? His network canceled both his shows this year.
Oh.
Yeah.
Are they giving the retreat to you right now? The silent
Yeah. No, not slight, well,
just
no, they're doing
days.
The Lum Rim.
Yeah, the next part.
He's going to the Lum Rim teaching. So.
Oh, that's good. Has he been able to actually relax, or is he
no.
staying busy?
No. He was going to do this retreat there and everything, you know, be in retreat mode. He calls today, can't talk, I've been made a teaching assistant. And I said, of course you have. There goes the retreat. It's all right. We're waiting for action.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, guys, we're back. We're more at peace with ourselves than ever. So who has questions? Mm-hmm.
Similar to the question I asked last night, which is...
You still haven't got it.
Well, no, I got last night, but so last night was love on the side,
yeah.
And this is love...
So what is what am I talking about, love
yes.
on the center? Well, what I've been saying about your actions during the day, if you lead with love and you consider your life a work of art, then you're up at night before you go to sleep thinking about what the next day is going to be, right? Who can you help? What can you do? What kind of mischief can you get up to? What kind of imp can you be? So does your day consist of, for instance, you get up in the morning and you pick the outfit you're going to wear so that you'll be an absolute delight to behold, okay? For everyone else's sake, right? You are driving to work, you park, and you plug the meter next to you with at least 50 cents. You get to work, and you get to work early, and you clean the kitchen with mint soap. The office kitchen, which is never clean, and which you're always complaining about never being clean. You clean it, okay? You notice when someone comes in that they sigh and they kind of sit down heavily. And when they get up to get a cup of coffee, you leave a candy kiss on their desk and a little note with a heart on it. You know, you just go about your day like this and you think it up the night before. You make a boutique designer day. Now, of course, things will interfere because, you know, I was saying last night, your plan for your day will be interrupted. One of the ways you coach actors to look real on stage, as you say, make a plan for your day and let everybody interrupt it. Then you're going to come to life, right? You keep trying to keep going with the plan for your day until someone makes you do something else. Well, that's like life. So you let go your plan for the day. You let go of your plan for the day, even if it's a good one. If something else happens, you move there. You go there. See, you are not the subject. You are not the subject anymore if you're on a spiritual path. Your happiness, you should know by now, comes from making other people happy, period. So why would you not want to make other people happy all day long, all night long, right? That's how to make yourself happy. So your plan for your day should be all about making other people happy and making other people's day special, miraculous. You know, when we have love on the side, we're doing this somewhat. You know, we'll make a fuss over someone on their birthday, whereas 364 other days... You know, what are we doing for them? What kind of, what is dinner like? What is lunch like? Is there anything special about it at all? You know, and you think to yourself, well, I'm going to be tired. Well, that's going to be tiring. Oh, my God, that'll be so tiring. Planning all those surprise parties, that's really tiring. But don't forget, a spiritual path is absolutely paradoxical. The paradox of it is it will give you energy. It will make you feel high. You'll be a contact high. Okay?
Yeah.
Sure, if the intention is dripping with vitriol, right? I'll do this for you, you know?
Or
it's got to be pure.
Experience. I think that I try really hard to practice that and then find that my patience just is so thin and I just fall apart because I'm not receiving. I can see how behind it there's this...
Yes, and that's what's wearing you out.
I think I'm doing such lovely right. things. I think I feel it. I feel joyous when it's happening, and then there's this moment where I get tripped up and I feel incredibly let down for the lack of appreciation the unrewarding or the lack of response or not having the same thing done for
right.
me.
So right.
it's just, the ego just gets really...
Yeah.
It's so intense.
So here's what you have to understand, okay? Very, very important. There is a gap with karma. And you don't know how long that gap is going to be. The more that you get... Well, could be. Could be. But, see, the more you practice, the more you study, the higher you get in your practice, the more you'll learn how to make more powerful karmas. You'll make them harder and faster, and they will ripen harder and faster, and pretty soon they'll get together. I always say, like, the freckles make a tan, you know. They will start to get together, and pretty soon the stream of your life will be filled with happy events. But you have to understand something, okay? This is really important. I was just thinking today, coming here, I have to teach this again because I want everyone to know it. I think it's so extraordinary. If I walk in the door and I say something sweet to my husband, Rick, and he turns on me and lashes out at me and says something like, you know, what the hell are you talking about? You know that's not true. Just cut it out. Don't baby me or whatever it is. Like, and he always says, will you stop using this example? I've never done that to you. Well, I'm sorry. So here I'm using it again. So I'm taking him off the hook. He has never done that. If he did. Okay. Because that kind of thing happens to us all the time. When that happens, we don't just experience something nasty being said to us by someone we love. We experience the disintegration of our entire world. Because that's what we're relying upon. We are leaning upon that person, and maybe that person alone, or that person among two or three, that are going to give us consistent results, you know, that we love being sweet to and we make special efforts for. There we go. You know, it's like we really put out for that person and, you know, suddenly what do we get, right? The water on the head. Those are two different incoming karmas. So let's go over the laws of karma, okay, of how your actions play out in their results. Like produces like. Good actions produce good results. Bad actions produce bad results. How could it be otherwise? It sounds very simple. It's extremely profound. Matthew 7, Christ says, you cannot get figs from thistles. He says, a good tree will produce a good fruit, and an evil tree will produce an evil fruit. Okay? Same thing. He also says in that same chapter, really interesting chapter, chapter 7, it's pretty much one-stop shopping, he says. Ask and it shall be given you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. For whoever asks receives. He that seeks will find. And for him that knocketh, it shall be opened. Okay? I used to just sit with that verse when I was a child, just thinking, what is this? What does this mean? What does this mean? Well, then he says, you know, something like, if your child asks for a fish, will you give him a stone? You know, or if someone you love asks for this, will you give him something horrible? And he says, if you, being, and then the King James Version says, evil, in other words, ignorant, Know how to give good gifts unto your children. How much more will your Father who is in heaven know how to give good gifts unto them that ask him? Therefore, he says, whatsoever anyone does to you that is good, do you also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. And that's the same little set of verses that also, you know, a good tree produces a good fruit, then ensues. So he's given you the whole thing. He said, what you ask for, you'll be given. Right? Whatever door you knock on, it will be open if and when you begin to behave out of this set of values. You do to others as you would have them do to you. That's the key. He says, it's the law. It's the law. Right? And the prophets, meaning it's what everyone who's ever walked the earth that had enlightened things to say has said. Every one of them has said the same thing. You know, it's karma. There's the law of karma right there. So like produces like. And then the second law of karma. Karma grows. Your actions will have consequences. And unless you either purify them or you stop the result from happening in some way, you interfere with it, the consequence is going to grow, just like lying. You see it in lying. You don't stop your lie. You don't tell someone the truth. You don't make up for it in some way or purify it. You know, there's specific things you can do to purify an action. But they have to do with a makeup activity. You have to do something to make up for it because you're the only judge. It sits as a crime in your own mind. You got to do something. You got to do the time, you know. And when that's done, you name something that you're going to do to make up for it. Can be with the person or not with the person. They say you can use third-party karma. You can do something sweet to someone else and dedicate it to cleaning up that action. Okay? You can read in a holy text. You can do some studying. You can do some meditating. Something that's doable within a finite amount of time, and then when it's done, mark it in your mind. Say, that's clean. I'm clean of that. Okay? So second law, karma grows. Third law, if you do a karmic action, you will receive a result. And if you don't do one, number four, you won't receive a result. It is law. Whatever you do is going to have a consequence. And they say in Tibetan Buddhism something that I think all religions espouse, which is the results of your actions are environmental. You know, they've done experiments wiring up people who are doing acts of compassion. The effect is felt not only by the person performing the action and the person receiving something sweet from that person, but anyone who witnesses it. It has effect on them. It is the reason why your actions have such a universal result is because you and your world are the same thing. Because you were born in a context, because you have a particular set of lenses on, the world you see is your world. It's a reflection of who you have been, of the family you were born into, of the prejudices you were taught, of your education, right? Of everything that's ever happened to you. That's what you see, right? This is why a spiritual path begins to take off those lenses. You know, like they say in the Bible, when I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. And then face to face. You get to really look at yourself. That's growing up, to have the courage to look at yourself. So I was saying yesterday, this little technique of keeping a book with a top 10 in it, protecting life. In what way have I protected life today? You write it down. In what way have I not protected life today? Am I supposed to be taking vitamin C? Did I take it? You're just as valuable as everybody else. Did I take a pencil off the stairs that I thought might trip somebody, or did I just walk by it? And what am I going to do about that, to do? And then, did I steal? Did I steal people's time? Did I interrupt people? Did I steal the focus? Right? Did I give, or did I protect other people's property? You know, you go into a bathroom, like the bathroom in here. You know, the bathroom is very clean. The bathroom down the street at Toby's was really a mess. You know, I just take a paper towel and pick up all the junk on the floor and put it in the wastebasket. I mean, really, people haven't died from doing that. They really haven't, you know? Then someone walks in and they say, oh, Toby's is such a lovely restaurant. They keep their bathroom so nicely. And you give away the credit. You dedicate it. Dedicate the action. Say, I dedicate this. You know, may the earth be clean. May we all participate in this. And let other people think that it was Toby, whoever Toby is. Yeah.
I have a question, Lindsay.
Yeah.
Why are anonymous good karmas so hard to come by? Why do we so want the barista to see us putting the tip in the jar?
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me crazy. I want them to see me tipping.
Yeah, because we all want to be daddy's special girl, you know? We all want to be mommy's special boy. The ego wants so much attention. The part of growing up on a spiritual path is to understand the way to get the attention is to give the attention. See, what's so relaxing when you finally really begin to live out of this is that you just don't worry about getting attention anymore. You can put the tip in the jar without anybody seeing you because ka-ching, that just registered. That just registered. You dedicate it, you know that's coming back to you. Someone's going to be a big tipper with you. You don't know exactly what form that will come back in. And sometimes we're really stupid about it and we just don't see it happening. We say, oh, there haven't been any miracles in my life lately. And people start to say what's going on and I can go, 1, 2, 3, 4. I had this recently with someone who was depressed and felt that karma wasn't working, and his father had been extremely ill, very, very ill. And the discussion had been kind of, you know, how do we deal with the last moments of his life? And his father's illness turned around like that, just fine. And I said to him, excuse me, you're depressed? You feel like you have no authorship of your world? You feel like nothing that you've ever done to take care of people has ripened? Really? Look again, you know. What do you think this is, medication? Meds don't work. Nothing works in that way. There is no self-existent nature to a medication that it works, or everybody would take that medication and be cured by it. The aspirin does not cure your headache, ever. Or it would cure your headache all the time, and it would cure everyone's headache all the time. You cannot take an aspirin and your headache will go away. You can take an aspirin and you still have the headache. You can take an aspirin and your headache will go away. You cannot take an aspirin, right? And you get a headache. Or you don't get a headache. It's all those possibilities are true. That means the aspirin doesn't work in that way. So why does the aspirin sometimes work? And they say it's because you took care of someone else's body. It all comes down to love, that love does in fact make the world go round. Love does hold up the room. Some people's rooms don't stay held up. Some people don't have homes. Have you helped someone find a place to live? Some people don't get rides. Have you given someone a ride? You know, and then the gratitude, just the gratitude, giving a tip. You know, how many people are involved in your cup of tea? Planting the tea, maybe scientists genetically figuring out what tea is best. I mean, how do they know all those things they put on the back of the box? You know, well, this is the inside of the leaf of the blah, 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 blah. It was generally, you know, like, who does that? Millions of people are working on that. And the people who went out there in the hot sun with those hats on and whatever and just pulled all those tea leaves off, and then the drying or the curing or the whatever, and then they're putting them in the bags and then putting a little tag in the bags, and someone who comes up with little sayings on the tags in the bags. you know, and who thought about the marketing and all the meetings about the marketing of the tea and then the box and then the blah, blah, blah. And then eventually on the trucks or the planes or the trains or the boats or whatever and coming to you, and then you go down the street to Toby's and you say, can I have a cup of tea? And it's like nothing to you. This is how we're royalty, you know. It's like we don't even, it's like, get me a cup of tea, you know. Like 9 million people, just go get me a cup of tea, you know. Really. We're so arrogant, we don't even think about it. So the tip, you know, like who are we to want to be seen giving the tip? Like my father used to teach me, be a big tipper. He said, it costs you very little and you will make somebody's day. I've heard cab drivers say about celebrity actors, not a good tipper. Not a good tipper. I'm like, oh my God, may those words never come out of their mouth about me. You know? I think, you know, oh my God. Oh yeah, that's bad. That's bad. But you see, that's karma coming, ripening. Guy didn't tip well. He's got someone in his car with everybody who's getting in the car. So-and-so, not a good tipper. Whoa, that's not good. That's not good. Here's something that I want to just say. This is beautiful. In a very subtle way, the media's extensive use of surveys and other measurements shape our sense of what is important and what we value. They keep us focused on a wide range of issues and activities over which we have little control. They tell us how well we're doing, how well our city, state, or country is doing, how well anything they believe we should value is doing. Without discernment on our part, they can set the agenda for our thoughts, priorities, and actions. Examining what measurements we are interested in and what we measure for ourselves can provide some insight into our values. Contemplative living, living in true relationship with self, God, others, and natures, living in true relationship, we have to unpack that one, with self, God, others, and nature, is a radical change in the way we approach life. Contemplative living sets an agenda and a context for lives that are our own contexts. With our relationships as the lens through which we discern what is important. In other words, not success, but how happy our relationships are, right? As the context, as the main context for our lives, for what is important, what we discern as important, what we value, what we decide to do or not do, we begin to see the external influences for what they really are. When our relationships become our standard of measurement, we connect our inner spiritual life and our external active life. We connect them, body, speech, and mind, one thing. Our everyday life becomes our contemplative spiritual life. This is what we're going to teach at the summer retreat this summer. So, approach your spiritual path with all the wit and intelligence and sophistication that you actually have. Right? Don't dumb it down. Don't give it over. Right? We feel sometimes more capable of going to the university than going, you know, to a class on spirituality. Stop disqualifying yourself for whatever reason. These teachings are not coming to you for no reason. You are bringing them to yourself. You have earned them, and you are creating them. You're writing them as you go. These are coming from you. We have the education. We're cosmopolitan. We read and write beautifully. We're well-fed, and for the most part, we have a lot of free time. If we aren't capable of this, who is? If these teachings are showing up for us, then we're it, like tag, we're it. The universe is not random. If it were, then it would have to be totally random, which might be nice, but we have better destinations. Be quiet. Be quiet. Be quiet when you practice and be more quiet in your life. Listen. Be a listener. Be in a receptive mode. most of the time. Be available most of the time. Okay? Get your face out of a machine. I was over at Toby's. Maybe four people were talking to each other. Everybody's face was in a machine. We are starting to select out for not being able to even concentrate on one thing. This is really, really serious for us all. We are so distracted. You know, the fact that you can go on a page and there's something here going like this, there's something there going like this, and something there going like that. You know, that's not a good environment for us. It isn't. We want to be still. If we want to be whole, we have to know how to be still. Okay? All music rests on a bed of silence. All art rests on a bed of space. All acting rests on a bed of presence. Okay? This comes from being still, knowing how to be still. You can completely stun an audience by shutting up. Two, keep a journal. Wrestle with the platitudes. What is enlightenment? What is love? Do you have a dream for your life? Do you have a dream for your day? What are you doing toward it? If you wanted to be an artist, if you wanted to become a professional, you'd be doing something toward it every single day. You know, you don't need an agent. Alleluia. You can be your own agency. You know, get on it. Plan it. Design it. Do the sketches for the big painting. Right? Because the big crisis is going to come. And then you will be ready. And then you will be ready. And people will help you all through your life if you show up as the helper most of the time. What are you waiting for? Take some action each day toward being fully alive, towards being the miraculous. Give yourself each day a quality of God and play the part. Do this not as a crude imitation of the fact. You know how. Kiss it. Just kiss it. Don't go over the top. Open out time. Hurry is a sickness. Here's Krishnamurti. Thought identifies itself with the name and the form and is the I in all the content of consciousness. It is the essence of fear, hurt, despair, anxiety, guilt, the pursuit of pleasure, the sense of loneliness, all the content of consciousness. If one runs away from it, one hasn't solved it. But if one remains with it, not identifying oneself with it, if you just stay in the fray and breathe, okay? Because one is that suffering, because it belongs to you anyway, then all your energy is present to meet this extraordinary thing that happens. When one observes suffering in oneself, not escaping it, but remaining with it totally, completely, without any movement of thought, without any alleviation or comfort, but just holding to it, then one will see a strange psychological transformation take place. I wanted to read you on the heels of that. The idea that truth is the development of the individual must be set aside. He goes on. He says, something which is of its very nature imperfect, and this individuality is, but you can wear it down by constant adjustments, by adjustments of conduct and action. That is why it matters vitally what you are now, and why you should put aside all philosophical and metaphysical theories. What matters is the manner of your life, the manner of your behavior, your conduct, your action, your choice. Not whether the self exists or whether that which exists is not the self, whether it is the I that progresses or the not I. Who eventually cares for theories, says Krishnamurti. What really matters is that you are in sorrow. When a man is caught in sorrow, he wants to be free. He wants to establish within himself a tranquility and a peace. He needs a mind that is pliable and eager. And this can only be developed through continual choice. Choice is the continual discovery of truth. This is not a theory with me. There must be that eager awareness for continual adjustment, never yielding for a second. I myself have done it, says Krishnamurti. I am putting it forward to you either to take it or to leave it. The wise man, the man who is in sorrow, and the wise man is in sorrow because he is all the time struggling to find out. There's Emily Dickinson. Examines, analyzes, seeks out the fundamental principle, and through that criticism, through impersonal examination, becomes aware of the total reality. So hold when you're having difficulty. Have a moment of silence in yourself. Allow for what you feel, the cry in the wilderness, the injustice of the world, the hurt, the fear, the sorrow, to play out as the proof that you are not alone. Let it happen, the altogether of your aching heart. It's so beautiful.
Who wrote the list of things that you were reading?
Krishnamurti. Yeah.
I have a question. I mean, I don't know, there's just so many things I'd love to talk about. love that image. I'm going to play that one for my husband. I guess the probability is one thing that really like steps out. That like when a disaster happens, that there's maybe even more than a 50-50 chance that like it's like the best thing that's ever happened to us. And there's so many ways where, I know our instincts can, like, lead us wrong, but I'm just, like, wondering, like, the more than 50%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's where the more than 50% lies. It's coming from you. If you really understand that, you'll know that there's everything you can do about it. It's a huge opportunity. It's a huge opportunity. Because usually a disaster wakes us up like nothing else. It's like all the cards are in the air suddenly rather than all being nailed to the ground. And you realize that everything is changing and you realize that at any moment you can step into a truly beautiful life. And you hate this and you don't like it and you can't stand it and you're falling apart because of it. But it has opened the possibility of an entirely different life. You can get really thoroughly sick of yourself in a disaster. And then you start to do something different. That's why there's a good deal more than 50% possibility. There's total possibility. Like what happened to Pema. She found her life the day that she felt she was losing her life. But she took the opportunity. It's because we're on this track where we've decided how it should go, and when it doesn't go that way big time, then we label it disaster, bad, terrible, destruction, everything's awful, my life is a waste, I'm a loser, whatever. Karma is kind of like energy. It's more like energy. It's like weather. That's good. It's like weather. You know, when it rains, we're responsible for the weather that we see. But we don't say to ourselves, we're losers. It's really coming down today. You know, we don't say, my life is a waste because there's, you know, the probability of 70% rain today. There's a probability of 70% disaster today for us, emotionally and everything else, probably from the karma that we have in our pockets. But it's weather. And if we want to change the weather, we know what to do.
So I heard this amazing presentation this week, a mathematician presenting on probability. And you know, he said it's all about what bet you're going to make.
Mm-hmm.
Like what bet are you going to make that it's going to rain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this really interesting example where he said, "Can I throw it out there?"
Sure.
Okay.
No.
Joe's quiet. Is it more likely that he's a salesman or a librarian? How many people say salesman? How many people say librarian?
Librarian. Salesman talk all the time.
Okay.
You'd say that too, library.
You know, it doesn't matter that they're, you know.
How do we know Joe can talk?
You know, but does it matter that there's more than 100 salesmen for every librarian? There's probably like 1,000 salespeople for every librarian. But, you know, we make these like connections, and so like we're willing to place these. Anyway,
but things don't work that way. See, all probability like that, that's like statistics and like advertising. Things don't work that way. It's like I just listened to this course, I think I was saying it last night, on color. This big analyst of color works with corporations to tell them, you know, about their packaging and their marketing, etc. You know, and there was one section on yellow and said, you know, if you want to be attractive to a man, don't wear, you know, sunflower yellow. It's like, you know, by everybody's vote, it's like the worst thing you can wear. And I thought, you know, if Sophia Loren is walking down the street in a yellow dress, everybody's going like, eh. Really? Really? You know, at a certain point, it's according to those lenses that you have on. For that person who's giving the course, that works for them. You know, this is like the film industry. It's so incredible to watch them. They're like struggling to figure it out when a My Left Foot movie comes along and it sweeps all the awards and they've been spending millions doing the blockbuster this and the big that, and they're just like deer in the headlights going, what just happened? And you go, well, there was a genuine human interest story. And there are people out there, folks, not numbers. And somebody recognized that and talked to the folks, you know? And that won the awards. Hello? All their research down the drain. Right? It's so funny to watch them try to come up with it again and again and again and again, you know? And they're just trying to make last year's hits because that's all they know. So the probability guy is working in, it would be hard to know whether he's working in a causal universe probably. But he's trying to name self-existent causes as if there are causes out there. There are no causes out there. There are only causes in here. There are no self-standing causes for things. People see all kinds of different causes for things, right, that they think are causes. That's why they're always trying to sell you something. This will make you well. No, this will make you well. This will remove your warts. No, this will remove your warts. No, this will remove your warts. All those people are saying, this thing out here, apart from your perception of it, will cure your warts. If any of them cured warts, any of them at all, a single one, we would know it in 5 minutes. And all the other products would be removed from the market. And the advertising business would fall apart. Advertising relies on the fact that things don't work. Right? It's wonderful. You know, it's right in front of our noses and we don't see it. We buy into it. We buy into it. That's why, you know, to be a spiritual practitioner, that's why you need training and you need discipline. You've got to hold while all of this is coming at you. All of this is coming at you so, as if something external is going to make you happy. And you're bombarded with that message. That's why you need to be quiet, why you need to have a place that you can go where you don't know anything about the newspaper, you don't know who your friends are, you don't know anything. You just go. And be quiet and listen and do a simple practice, right? Just settle yourself down. Yeah. So you aren't like a stick in the wind all the time. you know, over here, not over here. Just be quiet. This is why things like the summer retreat, I have to say, are really, really valuable, to take a week out and just be quiet and listen to some really beautiful teachings. It has a huge impact because it's so rare that we do that, that you'll feel an enormous support from that. Did I answer the question? If you lead with love, if you are hell-bent for fire, to plan a beautiful day to be available to others and what they want, and to just think up some stuff on your own, what would put a smile on someone's face? Transparent actions are terrific because they guarantee that you can't be doing them in order to get something back. If your actions are at all attached to having something done to you in return, that's trade. That's not giving, right? That's trade. There, you're hoping for an exchange. And once you do something, you have to relax and give up the idea that you're going to order it up, you know, within a certain amount of time. And it may not show up in the form that you think. You may not notice when it's... But I would say, I don't think that enlightenment is like, wow, it just happened. Boy, this is amazing. I think it's more like the way... My experience of a spiritual path is you look back suddenly and you go, boy, 3 years ago, I was so unhappy. I actually cannot say that I'm unhappy anymore. I am not unhappy anymore. 14 years. I'm not unhappy anymore. Not that bad things aren't happening. They're happening. But I look upon them so differently. And I'm having a great time. So that's progress. That's progress. But there's no sort of Saul on the road to Damascus kind of thing. Now, maybe it'll happen that way. I don't know. But this is really good. This is really good. All of this is really, really worth doing. It's really worth doing. I mean, what else are you going to do? And as my teacher says, and how you doing so far?
How's it going?
How's it working out? Yeah, he always has a leg to stand on, I say. Yeah, because he makes a good point for all of us. Anybody else have a question?
I just think the one that, I think also the word expectation just came up. Just that it's so powerful to try to resist expectation.
Gabrielle.
Because it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's filtered in all the commercialism around us, consumerism, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. just being told how you should live, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's the expectations of, I mean, in my own predicament of having children and hoping, you know, even just teaching them to say please and thank you, and then it's like, well, hold on a minute, maybe I shouldn't be telling them to say please and thank you and just be giving them a nice meal and picking them up and this and that and so on and so on and so on. And it's hard to negotiate. You know?
Yeah, of course.
It's so interesting that you, because I think digesting concepts is a huge part of allowing it to filter through, allowing it to, because there's this constant thing that comes up, which is like, mm-hmm. well, what about mm-hmm. teaching my children to be grateful?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I guess...
You can never teach your children to be grateful. Take that right now. You can teach them to say please and thank you. And it might be a bit mechanical. But you do it with the idea that it will pave the way for things to be easier for them. If they say please at the front of a sentence, please may I have, rather than, give me that, right? It's going to pave the way for things to come to them more easily. And you can explain that to them. Right? Children will never be grateful.
Why?
Because you're like the walls and the floor. You're just there. You're like the walls and the floor. You know? And you're just there. Of course you're making breakfast for them. Like, what else would they expect? like to come down and there's no breakfast?
Absolutely.
I mean, you're the mom. This is the part that you play, right? They're in the mom, dad, and children play. And you play the mom. You play the mom, so make breakfast already, okay? But you can teach them, but your lines are, please may I have a muffin. That's their line.
And mother's line is not to be like, you're so ungrateful.
Yes, yes, yes. Because you cannot possibly make someone grateful. See?
You can teach them by being, though.
Yes.
You can teach them by showing gratitude.
Yes.
Well, for them.
Yes, or just showing your own gratitude in front of them about others. And
yeah.
Yeah, setting an example.
So I have a question.
Just, I think, you know. Gabrielle, they are grateful.
They are.
They are grateful because you are their mom and they adore you. And they are grateful.
And they're who you want.
But they may not be able to identify the experience of being grateful because, as I say, you're like the water that they swim in.
Yeah.
That you know, it's like, what, be grateful for the air? What is like? Huh? Where's there not air? You know, it's like, yeah.
No, that bewilderment does happen when I explode. Yeah. I need time.
I think the hard thing always for parents, especially with younger children, is you will give 190%, and then just as you've given 195%. You know, they'll make some whiny demand and that'll be it. You know, you don't have 196% in you.
Do you know what I just...
Yes, do you know what I just did? And, you know, I'm having a personal experience of grown children not knowing. They don't know. I was a single parent and they don't know. They don't know. And so you have to just give it away. Say, this is the role that I signed on for. The role of eternal giver, mother, with an endless supply of milk. That's my role. And their line is, please and thank you. But it doesn't have to be said with feeling, just simple. Eventually, they will have children. And you will have your revenge. You just wait. They will have families. Then they will know. There's the gap.
I have a parenting question, but you said something.
Yeah, no, my question was not specifically parenting, also just, you know, relationships in general that involve love, whether it be romantic and a partner or a husband or wife or a parent or a sibling or whoever, at what point when you're really, you know, trying to live ethically and morally and keep your vows and do your practice, do you decide that something just is not going to go the way you think it should, needs to, and could, and do you, as a conscious act of something, I don't know what you call it, but just decide, okay, that's it, and I love you, but from afar. You see what I'm saying?
Meaning that you can't engineer what you want to have happen,
uh-huh.
And so you let go.
Yeah.
Probably a really good idea.
Yeah.
Because that's samsara.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Right. But it's so curious to me, even something that is not really negotiable in terms of... So I'm specifically speaking of a sibling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just have this... She's in town right now. It's my older sister. And I just have this distinct feeling like this is never going to go the way I want or envision or dream it could be,
yeah.
Or that I want to have. And I'm done, like, with the fantasy.
Yeah.
So then, okay, here it is.
See, so often it's the fantasy that we want, and we're not willing to look at the real person and let them be who they are. This happens all the time in families.
Well, I'm willing to let them be who they are, but I'm not willing to feel the way I feel around them.
Good. Let that go.
Right.
If you let... You see, there's a fantasy involved in the way you feel around them.
That's true.
You have described the relationship. Grandma should be plump. Mm. Grandma should be rosy. Mm. Grandma should be laughing. Mm-hmm. Grandma should bring the children things every time she visits. Grandma shouldn't visit too much. When grandma, you know, grandma's sort of short and squat. When grandma's tall and thin and gay and political and thrifty, doesn't want to give the children anything, that's my job, then we have this round, plump grandmother we're struggling to pull the other person into that identity that we want because it's how grandma should go. And we're at war with the political gay woman in front of us who hasn't brought a thing to the kids in years, mm-hmm. right? This is where you have to pay in the local mint, where you have to let go. And it's a loss of the grandmother that you want. It's the loss of the dream grandmother. That grandmother's nowhere to be found. But there's a human being in front of you, and you have no idea how delightful. See, there's that sauce on the side. Mm-hmm. You're resisting it. I don't like garlic. I don't want tangerine on my, you know, grandmothers are chicken, roasted chicken. I don't want tangerine coulis, mm-hmm. right? But tangerine coulis might be the most unbelievable thing you've ever tasted. You don't know mm-hmm. because you're so busy keeping it on the side. Mm-hmm. Lead with love. Smash, they say bhakti yoga. Smash it. Smash the fantasy grandmother so you have access to the human being in front of you. Okay? Because the person that you're seeing is the person who's responding to your violence. Mm-hmm. You're trying to destroy them every time you meet them. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they're defensive. Of course, they're whatever. They're just, you know, the shrapnel is coming at them, right? They're getting tissue damage. We all do this. We all do this. And if you can see it, it's really, do the exercise, write out who this person should be and how they're failing the mark. And then write out who you think might actually be there and take a look at that. You know, we want to bring everyone into the living room. Ultimately, we want to love the world. That's what we're aiming at. And then we have the world loving us.